and welcome to this week's episode of Political Bark. This is the first episode of Political Bark in 2024. Thank you for listening. I'm here with Halvar, and we're going to discuss geopolitical changes in 2023 and 2024. Last time we met, we discussed the changes between going from a bipolar world order, unipolar world order, to a multipolar world order. We predicted, actually, that was going to happen. It was back 2 years ago. We predicted that we were going to be in a multipolar world setting, both from a geopolitical perspective, but also financially. And I think that our predictions were correct. We are now in perhaps starting one of the hardest decades I've ever known. And living in extremely difficult but interesting times. So today, this episode is called Navalny is Dead. I think he's unfortunately the cherry on the top of the cake, the block of ice on the top of the iceberg. That is the dire strait, the dire situation of the political systems in both East and West right now. So I wanted to say quickly, personally, I'm moving to Saudi Arabia, to NEOM, in a couple of days. I've been in Oslo and France and Europe the last year. I've been working with the Norwegian government in the international section there, discussing Norwegian foreign policy onwards, and I'm going to continue doing that. And today with Halvar, we are discussing the situation with Russia, Europe, China,
US.
The US yeah. Also. Halvar, do you want to start talking about one of the topics?
Well, let's start with Navalny, though. He was found dead this morning. He took a walk in his prison camp somewhere in northern Russia, and I think complained that he was complained that he felt sick, and then he died earlier or later on he died the same day. So I think there's no doubt that he was poisoned. Of course the Russian government denied any culpability.
Yeah, I think it's some say that it's a surprise that Putin would keep him alive for that long.
Yeah.
Some say that this is a representation of how difficult the Russian government and state is doing, because if they were doing better, they would have let him live as an opposition, or even made him an opposition leader. I don't know. Personally, I believe that this is sort of a warning to the West that this is how we deal with opponents.
And it happened just a few days after the interview with Tucker Carlson happened also.
Have you watched that interview? I think I've watched bits of it. I have watched bits of it. What do you think about it?
Well, basically, it starts off, I've watched some of it. I watched it on like 1.5 times sort of speed. But it starts off with like half an hour or something of a history lesson which Putin gives to Tucker. And, Putin asks Tucker to begin with if he wants to have a serious talk, or if it's just going to be like whatever, not serious interview. And of course, Tucker laughs and says that he wants to have a serious interview. And Putin goes back, I think he starts with the 8th century. Yeah. About the Christianization of the Kiev and Rus, and this sort of first prince, Voldemar or Vladimir, who was the son or grandson of a Scandinavian Viking or something.
I think it's, it just tells us a lot about how Putin decided that, how old is he now, 70? I guess he decided that if anyone's going to do this in this lifetime, it has to be me. If anyone's going to pull these strings and put this together, it has to be me. Therefore, I think he also had an extreme courage, courage and extreme sort of force behind everything he does, because he has, this is the last chance. And that's why also I think this scenario of the historical reasoning behind everything he's doing now, as you said, back to the 8th century.
Well, that's where he started.
You know, he's replaying this in his own mind and in everyone else's mind in Russia as a reality, fueling everything he does according to that. So, I mean, that's his raison d'être.
Yeah, and the interview is bizarre. I think at one point he... He talks a lot about Poland and the countries or the countries in Eastern Europe, and especially Poland. I think at one point he actually says that the Poles sort of cooperated with Hitler, and then they forced Hitler to begin World War II by not cooperating with him or something. So it was, I mean, there were lots of historical inaccuracies in that interview. But I mean, Tucker says that in the introduction, he says that, you know, Putin believes that Russia has historical claims to the lands east of the Dnieper, the river that cuts through Kiev and Ukraine. So I mean, Putin was basically arguing that, or at the beginning of the talk, Putin is arguing that it's due to historical reasons and not NATO expansion that he invaded. I mean, he basically uses history and not NATO
I mean, what I think about with Putin is that Putin, as any other state leader today, is capable of using historical definitions and historical stories as reality. Because instead of going by the present moment and the status quo that we had established, Putin said, no. That's not what happened. This is what happened. And this is what's going to happen also, because I have my perspective. So instead of dealing with reality and everyone else as we had decided, I think that's an extremely scary way to think, because it means that anyone else also that has claim in history to something can do that.
So Tucker actually at one point asks Putin, because he goes on and on that part, or he talks about how one part of Ukraine was part of Hungary. So Tucker asks him, like, so have you told
Orbán
that he can reclaim parts of Ukraine? And Putin is like, seriously, he replies, like, no, I haven't told him that, but yeah, or something.
That's gonna be extremely tricky, because Austro-Hungarian Empire, but then we have to go back to the Ottomans. Ottomans also had claims in Europe and Hungary and all the way to Vienna. So I mean, this is an extremely crazy crazy way to think.
Yeah, because I mean, I've been reading a book about Russian organized crime, and Odessa, which is like a city in Ukraine, was known as once this vibrant city in part of the Russian Empire, full of life and lots of crime, but also it was sort of like a Paris of the, or something of the Russian Empire. There was lots of things going on. So I mean, is he going to reclaim that too?
Odessa? Yeah, interesting. I think what he has done is that since he has mixed up the rules of the game, everyone else has to also play by new rules. So today in Parliament, actually, we discussed Norway's belief in humanitarian law and in civil law and in the humanitarian sort of civil systems that we've put in place, the UN, etc., and the International Court of Justice, etc. How do we enforce and make sure that they are kept alive? Because right now, they're not really trustworthy, because they don't have the same value, because Putin has challenged them so much. So we discussed the fact that onwards, the only way to do that is perhaps to use economic incentives to say, okay, you know, what matters more than idealistic thinking? Well, that's money.
Of course, yeah.
So onwards, you know, if he's going to define the world according to history, then we have to define it according to the value of money and monetary pressure if we want to continue having a democratic perspective on I don't know how to say this, but partition of the world and geography also.
Yeah, but I mean, I think they've also they imposed loads of sanctions on Putin. But I mean, that also
economic sanctions, of course,
and that hasn't worked.
And none of that has worked because he had probably already expected that to happen.
Yeah, and I guess the price of oil and gas has increased, and so even though Russia cannot really trade that much with the West, it's oil and gas. The products are still very
demanded. Valuable. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think it's starting. I've read recently that the price of sort of labor has increased so much in Moscow because there is basically a shortage of laborers, you know, of workers.
Mm.
So I think that the price of the war is starting to sort of catch up with Russia. But I mean, so far they've also been able to withstand that. That being said, I think that Putin definitely had a plan with the interview. I think he did it because he's perhaps not desperate, but he definitely wants to sort of get his opinion voiced in the West. And it's probably because, you know, I think when they started the war in Ukraine, now it's 2 years ago, almost 2 years next week, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They never expected it to go on for this long. I think it was due to an intelligence failure that you know, there's an old expression going, nobody wants to give bad news to the czar. So I think it's definitely some sort of failure in the sort of intelligence channels, which made Putin sort of believe his own propaganda.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think also from last time we spoke, we discussed how the world was slowly moving from unipolar to multipolar, or I would say bipolar, perhaps east and west. But now what we're seeing is that there's power constellations in many parts of the world. And I think also what we should discuss is also where Norway is going to situate itself and in which type of power region or cluster Norway can sit, because we are not in the European Union. We are in the Schengen. We have a lot of bilateral agreements. We're part of NATO, but at the same time, what does NATO mean without the US? So we have a lot of work to do as a country. Also, I don't know if you have a perspective on who Norway can be in this multipolar world.
I think that Norway, I mean, we're a small country, and I think the idea of the sort of rules-based liberal order was that international law should be sort of the currency or the way to do business. But now we see a world where more and more where power is just the currency of international politics, or however we want to call it.
But how do we define power in this day and age? Is power, because the way I see power from a realpolitik perspective, power is the ability to coerce or enforce a certain desired outcome, or to stop an actor from doing a certain action. So that has to come through money or war.
Yeah, so I think military power, which is sort of the way Russia is doing things, and the US and NATO have done things in the past. And then you have economic power, which is, you know, the way that the Chinese do. They see sort of the... If you can sort of coerce someone to do your will without using military force, that's the way they do it in China. That's their view on power, is that the greatest sort of triumph is sort of not having to even wage war. So I think that power comes, I mean, you have military might and then you have economic might. Norway, I mean, it's interesting because Donald Trump could get re-elected in November. I mean, the last time we spoke, he had just left office, I think.
Mm.
But if he's re-elected, which he probably will be,
mm.
if he doesn't face trial and go to jail, I think he will either end up in prison or in the White House.
Mm.
So it's not surprising that he aims to go for the he's aiming for the White House.
I think that's
better than prison.
And so scary because he's reminding me of Putin's position also. Sort of, it's now or never. And that's the scary thing we have when you have nothing to lose.
Yeah, as a person. I think so.
He's been president. He wants to try that again.
He definitely wants to, and he's now facing some more legal pressure due to what was it, Stormy Daniels, and lots of different things. I think it's the same for Netanyahu in.
Exactly. So it's as if we're living in a world, we're in our 30s, it's as if we're living in a world where a lot of elderly, 70-year-old men are fighting for the last bits of power before basically they're going to die. And I think that's an extremely scary situation for everyone else to be in because they, as I said, they're not scared of anything at this point.
And they can do anything. And they're willing to do anything to stay in power.
To stay in power and to lead their country in a certain direction before they go. I mean, think of the amount of ego they possess also in order to have those thoughts about themselves and about their impact. I think,
Definitely, yeah. You
know, when we think about this, you know, we grew up in the 90s. We're moving into a world now where war is going to be such a daily occurrence where, you know, our lives, the next 10 years are going to be affected by war. Many places in the world, I don't think Gaza, Palestine and Israel and Ukraine and Russia is going to be, I think those are just sad to say, but two of the conflicts that are going to be a long string of other conflicts also. I believe personally that we're going to see more war in Europe in terms of perhaps in the Balkans. There's a lot of countries there that are either easy to take or easily convinced by, let's say, Russia.
Definitely. And also it could be the Baltics next to Russia.
Yeah.
Belarus. But the really scary thing, I guess, is are we going to have a war between China and the US over Taiwan?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the...
What do you think is going to happen with Taiwan?
It's tricky for me to say. I read the Graham Allison's book, "Destined for War: Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap?" A while back, I thought it was an excellent analysis. It basically doesn't give a yes or no answer. It shows that often, you know, going back to the war between Athens and Sparta, that often when sort of a rising power threatens to replace or sort of usurp the position of a ruling power, there's often war. I think that it's not, the economic ties between China and the US probably make it less likely, or it will probably mean that war is
less desirable.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But I mean,
obviously.
there is no question that for the Chinese, the past few hundred years have been sort of an anomaly in history because they've been so weak. I mean, for thousands of years, they were the sort of dominant player in that region of the world. Mm. And that's what they,
you know,
that's how they.
I remember back in last year, I was speaking with one of the foreign advisors to the Prime Minister of the UK, and he told me that, yeah, no, by 2034 or 2040 or something before that, China is going to be in ruins. And to be honest, when I heard that, I said, no, that's not possible. That's not possible, because the way China always sets out 10, 20, 30 years plans, and the way that China is developing right now, it doesn't seem like that it's headed for a massive economic downturn. Seems like it's headed for slow growth, but definitely growth. What do you think?
That's sort of a very good question, or that's a very relevant question. But there are so many reports that the economic growth in China is slowing down. I mean, China was China had a period of, 5% growth a year or something? I mean, that can never come back. That's because China was becoming more and more emerging from the period with the Cultural Revolution and all of that. And it had been weak. It had had a civil war in the beginning of the 20th century. Then Mao came and took power. And then you had, so you had sort of many years of economic growth that have been that has been really, really strong. I think that can never come back.
Mm.
I see a lot of people in a lot of economists and a lot of people in finance predicting that China will basically fall apart because its economic model isn't
sustainable.
Sustainable, yes. It's basically producing a lot, but it's not producing anything valuable. As I think we mentioned the last time, in China's interior, people are actually extremely poor. I mean, China by the coast is basically like Europe, but China's in its interior, China is a very, very poor country.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that I feel very lucky to be a Norwegian citizen in 2024, because let's look at the fact that we're an oil nation and a pretty young oil nation, and the fact that we have managed our oil resources in such a humble way. Considering that we have a green shift and we do respect and we do think about the necessity of creating sustainable natural resources and not focusing only on oil, the fact that the world for a moment at least had turned away from the green turned away from oil production and oil using oil and gas, it has created such a lack in the market that Norway, being such a small country with a small population, has a huge huge advantage onwards with the oil prices in the world going up. So,
of course, yeah.
You know, we are in a, to be honest, a gold mine in the sense that we have been so careful in how we have dealt with our oil. I think now, just to jump from China to Norway, I'm doing that because if we think about China, it's such a huge population, such a vast territory, and as you said, doesn't produce very much apart from exporting.
Yeah, it has very export oriented.
And the reason why China is jumping on every new type of industry, let's say now the chip industry, which they are leading in the world, which is an extreme advantage also, is obviously also because they need to renew. But I want to say that I'm very lucky to be from Norway and to live in Norway, where we have a mentality where, you know, we value human life and we value taking care of our populations.
We have the oil fund. We've saved up a lot of money.
And now
we're also trying to lead in the green shift.
Yeah, but I wonder if we're going to lead or if we're going to also have to right now Norway's main focus, or the government's main focus, is obviously going to be preparing for the conflicts around the world, in the sense that we are focusing on a strong army, strong military, military sector, more money in that. But that it's that's something that's very natural in the times we're living in, with our also neighbor in the north.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we've had. I think we've begun allocating a lot more money to the military. We should probably increase our military
budget. I mean, that is what's going to happen onwards. We're only going to increase it.
Our navy has been very, very busy for the past 2 years to show Russia that we're taking care of our own waters, our own territory. So I think that we'll probably have to invest more money in the military. That's for sure.
I have one question for you. If Trump wins in the US and therefore says that he wants to participate less in NATO and Europe's sort of neighborhood and actions, and also in terms of being a safety net for countries like Norway, how do you think that is going to affect our focus as a country? Now, right now, Norway is especially focused on Gaza, Palestine and Israel, and also Ukraine, Russia. How do you think Trump's presidency, and perhaps lack of interest in NATO and Norway, is going to affect our priorities?
Well, that's a tough question, because I mean, Trump could, you know, literally withdraw the U.S. from NATO, and I think that without the U.S., NATO basically has no function or no value. So I think that if that happens, I think that Norway will just have to be forced to establish a lot, I guess, closer ties to other European countries.
Yeah, so closer ties to European countries. Personally, I believe Norway should also have a lot of closer ties to countries outside Europe, bilateral agreements, alliances that are not directly in Europe, because Europe is one thing, but Europe doesn't have some strong economies, etc. But I think in the world we're living in now, we need to also be able to understand and to sort of copy different mentalities. And those mentalities are perhaps found outside the West sometimes. In terms of mentalities, I mean, we are not letting go of our democratic values, ideals, but we need to also be more attuned to the fact that the realpolitik is perhaps something we need to be using every day.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people around the world has seen the West as hypocritical. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people.
Of course.
Because of course. A lot of things that we did, we basically, especially the U.S. used or abided by international law when it saw fit. But when it's when it found that it shouldn't, it, like with the war in Iraq, it just ignored international law.
What do you think is going to be the West's biggest dilemma then the next 5 years? Is it a value crisis? Is it a resource crisis? Is it a focus crisis? Is it a war? I don't know.
Well, its biggest dilemma, I think, were, I don't know, I cannot, it's another tough question, but I think that what to do with NATO, though, if Trump wins, then that's going to be like a huge question. It's like, to keep NATO with a reluctant US, or how to sort of restructure its security alliances, probably.
Personally, I believe we have to be extremely resilient and extremely flexible the next years, because I think we need to be creative also in how we see our given systems and our established truths, because they can change very quickly, and we need to be able to come up with new solutions and new ways of viewing a security system that we haven't thought of before. But that was it for this intense conversation. Do you want to add something before we wrap it up?
No, I think that we were, like when we spoke the last time, it was 1 month later, we had the US withdrawal from Afghanistan. Then another 6 months later, we had the biggest military conflict in Europe since World War II. So I think that we were definitely on to something. That we have since October, we have had another war in Gaza,
predictive,
which basically divides the world. And in 1 year we could see, in 1 year we can see a Trump return to the White House, which would complicate things even further.
I think you know, it's super cool that our predictive analysis was correct. I just also want to say to everyone listening that me and Halvar are no gurus, and we are just political sciences nerds, and we enjoy this topic very much. We obviously think too much about it and analyze it so much. So take whatever you agree with in this episode and leave the rest. Thank you for listening, and see you'll hear from us soon again.